Welcome to the Family Express podcast, where our destination is resilient and connected families. Come aboard with your hosts, marriage and family therapists, Catherine DeBruin and Rhonda Evans, to explore the world of emotionally focused family therapy, a model developed by Sue Johnson and colleagues. Together with our guest speakers, our travels will map the EFFT landscape, highlighting lessons learned, shared fears, and the passion and curiosity that bonds our community.
Welcome back to the Family Express podcast, where our destination is resilient and connected families. Today, our guest is Preston Hurt, a licensed marriage and family therapist, adjunct professor, who is here to speak with us about what we will acknowledge as a hard topic, suicide and self-harm, particularly in youth. And Preston, we are just so grateful for you to be here today with us, speaking on such a hard topic. We are hopeful that this episode will be helpful for families and therapists. We do want to remind everyone to please take care of yourself as you listen to this episode. And if you yourself are suicidal or self-harming, or you know someone who is, to please reach out to your local resources, because there are people who are wanting to reach back to help. Preston, thank you so much for being here today. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you for having me on, Rhonda and Catherine.
Preston, I've been so excited to hear from you. Tell us a little bit about your work with high-risk children and families.
Yeah, so a lot of my experience is working with youth. Some of that started out in the county setting, so county mental health setting, but also even before working in or as a therapist, where I worked with a lot of youth as like a juvenile correctional officer, and just working with them as they're struggling with like suicidal thoughts or having suicidal attempts, which absolutely this is not an easy topic to talk about or to work through. I would say a lot of my current clients do struggle with suicidal thoughts or self-harming behaviors even. So just trying to really support families and even the youth as they're struggling with this and trying to show up for the kids and be the best possible parents and make sure that, you know, they're doing everything they can to show that they're showing up for their kids.
Thank you. And I think of families that come and or call us or come into treatment, but even my friends in my community who will often reach out to me and say, "Oh, my child is making these awful comments. My child is using self-harming comments." I mean, this is pretty common out there, really, that young kids, sometimes 5 to 9, are saying things like, "I want to die," or "I'm going to hurt myself," or "I wish I was not here."
Yeah, and it's extremely scary when these young kids are just bringing these statements up and having these such high emotions and trying to work with them and help understand, you know, parent-wise, it's extremely scary for their child to be expressing these things. But even for the child, they're having such high levels of emotion or high levels of hopelessness. So it's extremely difficult, and making sure that they're getting connected to therapists and also wanting to make sure we're all taking it seriously and showing up for them in the best possible way we can. It's not an easy task. It takes a lot of patience and understanding and trying to understand their experience to truly show up for them and understand what that pain is like for them to the point where they're bringing up these statements and having these emotions.
So it sounds like even as you're hearing that kids are making statements, comments like this, you're already saying like there's something behind it and there's maybe some kind of pain or emotional experience that's leading to this type of a comment, this type of a threat, this type of an externalization.
Yeah, I would say majority of times, I would say there are a lot of different emotions that come up that are kind of driving this. It's not always that to be the case, but it's important that we try to understand what they're truly feeling. And then as the parent, that is, I want to make sure I'm trying to listen to my child as much as I can. Now, as the therapist, it's the same thing. We're wanting to listen. We're wanting to show up for the kids and show up for the parents, which can be a balance to try to understand where the parents are coming from, trying to protect the child too, if there's some pushback from parents.
I was in a training recently, and it was about assessing sort of high conflict or violent type situations. And I think it might have been Jeff Schlutmacher in the EFT training world who said, there are these moments with people that you sort of call it an oh shit moment. Like something's happening and you're like, maybe that's a better word, an uh-oh moment. And I was thinking that I wonder if that would relate to families with children at high risk as well, that your child says something and you're like, wait, what? Like, whoa. Yeah. And if you have that response in your nervous system and you're like, what on earth was that? Like that comment just comes out of left field. That could really be a sign, like, slow down, mm-hmm. time to have a talk. Let's assess, let's get more information. Like, what is this and where is this coming from?
Yeah. And I would say that's the hardest part for parents, because it is that uh-oh moment or oh snap moment, let's say, where their fear is now taking over, the parent's fear, that is, of like, where did I go wrong? What did I do? How can I support and help? All the alarms are sounding off now. So I would say there are definitely similarities with the high conflict and safety concerns there, if there's safety concern comments that are being brought up. So when assessing, it is important, just as a therapist even, to try to slow down the process and the experience so that we can truly try to understand, as the parent and the therapist, what is coming up for this child? What is leading to them having these big emotions, having these comments come up to where they think things would be better off if I wasn't alive or if I was dead? And we truly hope that that's not what they want, but we do have to take it extremely seriously. And as a parent, to try to slow down and lower that alarm a little bit. Yes, internally, we may have that going off, but we need to try to figure out what's in the best interest of our child and how truly can I show up for you? So when the alarm's going off, taking that deep breath, understanding and checking in with ourselves, oof, this is what I'm feeling. I am feeling extremely scared. I am terrified. I don't even know where they learned this, why this is coming up. And then checking back in, like, okay, this can take a step back a little bit, or we can take a step back a little bit, put it on the shelf, my fear, that is, so I can truly show up for my child in this need. And when they're showing up for their child, it may look very differently depending on the child and what they're needing. Truly trying to have a conversation with them that's heartfelt and leading to the child knowing, like, gosh, my parents care about me. They're here for me. They want to understand my experience, which can be extremely difficult when those alarms are just blaring in our ears or in our bodies.
Wow, Preston, that's multi-layered, because you're saying kiddo is having something going on. Kiddo expresses it, and then the parents obviously get a fright. They have the uh-oh moment, which, if there is a true risk here, they should be frightened, right? Because there's a true threat on the table. And even if it's not a true threat, their nervous system, though, could remain heightened. And so you're saying parents need support as well as the children. Like, we need to hold a whole family system when something like this is going off, an alarm like this.
Absolutely.
And thinking of a family that recently came into our practice where parents came in and their very young child had made a threat like this at home, and they immediately, you know, came into treatment. But the parents came in initially. And one of the things I was thinking of is, how quickly should we get this kid in and get eyes on this kid? Because I certainly believe the parents know the child best, and yet sometimes parents don't always know what questions to ask or how to assess risk accurately. And obviously parents have their own reaction going on.
Absolutely. So when it comes to just thinking of that experience or that client that came through the door, yes, it's extremely important to work with the parents and kind of regulating their nervous system. But also we do need to truly assess what is happening for the child to get them into that support so that they can understand what's happening for the child, that is. Because sometimes there's limitations on what we're able to do depending on what like our setting is like. So county mental health wise, it may be where the child is the client. So there may not be as many parent interactions, which we do want to work with the full family system. But private practice wise, if we're working with the family and we're seeing it's indicated, hey, the child needs a therapist, you know, we can either connect them with a therapist that we collaborate with and work closely with to try to do that family work and support the parents. We could meet with the child. We have a lot of different options when it comes to private practice. I could list a whole lot off, but in regards to assessing, it's important for the parents to truly understand when you say this, what is your understanding of what happens? And if they're like, well, then I don't know, it's like a game where you restart over. Like, well, no, that's not maybe the case. But if it's a case of, I don't want to be here, I don't want to be alive, and I'm going to do this, that's where the alarms definitely need to sound. We need to get immediate support. And thinking of even like having a safety plan for an evacuation, let's say. We have all these safety plans. A lot of parents, families talk about emergency preparedness, but a lot of families don't have a safety plan or a plan in place if their child who has history of these things is actively having thoughts and are wanting to engage in these self-interest behaviors or these suicidal ideations or thoughts that they're having. So if we're running without a plan, it's hard for us to even know where to run. So the fact that for your family that came through the door, that's step one. That's a great step, great plan, start to the plan at least. Now you guys as the therapist can further assess what's going on, create a thorough safety plan, identify what are some of these triggers that lead to this thought coming up. And is it a statement that they actually are wanting to act on? I feel like went in circles there a little bit, but does that somewhat answer your question, Catherine?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm thinking into the family system as you're speaking about this. It's like the family system has to have a plan and they're in stabilization. Just so many parents are just actively keeping their kids alive and safe.
Yeah.
And think of the parents and how exhausting it must be over time for them to be in that high alert stage, right, in their nervous systems, and how it's important for us to support the parents. And then once the threat is truly over, can the parents actually relax? Mm. Or how does the system come back into balance again?
Yeah. And I think another part of it, just to add to that, is how do we truly know if this threat or this, I don't like to use the word threat, but this alarm, let's say, or snap moment is truly reduced. It's hard to really understand if it is truly reduced. So it's important to have those plans in place.
So educating parents on what to look for and how they would know if their kid is doing well or not.
Absolutely.
Would take them out of like a overreacting and also or micromanaging or being too hands off, right? Sometimes parents don't know how to gauge that. And they're so scared and the trust is kind of out of the system. They don't quite trust that the child will let them know, and they don't trust that they would read it accurately. And so it's so a tough.
If I'm hearing you correctly, there's a lot of fears that come up for parents of, am I trusting the system, like the alarm system? Is it accurate?
Yeah.
Am I trusting my child enough? How do I even know? Can I trust that this is accurate? Because are they isolating or are they not showing me those indicators that are those warning signs? Along with, am I doing a good job as a parent? These are all these things that are circling through a parent's mind. And then, like, how do I then show up for my kid? How do I truly know that I'm doing what's best for my kid or child? And when it comes to even the safety planning, this is kind of what's to help the parents know, okay, things are reducing. The risk is reducing of these are the triggers. These are some of those indicators of if my child is isolating more than usual, if they're sleeping in their bed all day long, this is another indicator. If they're making, let's say, negative comments about themselves more frequently, that's another indicator, like, hey, let's check in. A lot of the times, if, let's say, the risk has reduced, parents like, oh, okay, we have a chance to breathe. We can reset. We can kind of let them do their thing because I don't want to breathe down their neck, but I'm still afraid. Like, I want to make sure we're okay. So it's still important that parents are doing check-ins. Maybe not to the same extent of like, hey, are we having any suicidal thoughts right now? If there's indicators, yeah, like let's openly talk about this. But we do need to be able to give them that breathing room so that the kids understand, okay, mom and dad or parent, guardian, they are beginning to trust me. They do trust me and they do want to understand that I'm doing okay. Checking in as a parent, though, we want to make sure that we're accessible to them and that when they do reach out to us, because we want for them to reach out to us and let us know, like, hey, we're struggling, we're having these thoughts or urges, that we're going to respond appropriately and not sound the alarms, go to the highest extremes. We need to take it seriously, yes. Like, hey, how can I support you? How can I show up for you? And let's work through this together. It can be collaborative. It's not mom's way or the child's way. It's, hey, this is what we agreed on. Let's work together and let's do this so that we can all get that support and show up for each other.
Kristen, I'm having a response even as you're talking about this, because this topic can make me so anxious. But as I'm listening to you, I'm finding myself sort of relax a bit. And I think it's twofold. It's, you have this very calming, you slow down when you're speaking, you have this very at ease way of being with. And at the same time, I think it's that you're laying out a plan and you're saying, hey, there's a degree to which we can assess this and there's things that we can do and there's stuff we can do to monitor this. And we don't just have to be in this fearful state. There's actually markers that we can be watching for, and there's something that we can do. And I find that like easing in my system too.
Absolutely. If we have a plan, it's going to be more kind of like muscle memory. And we can refer to that. We know what it is. We've talked about it. Just like that, the fire escape evacuation plan that I briefly talked about, we're preparing for it. Hopefully it doesn't get to that point, but if worst comes to worst and we need to use it, we know what to do. We know how to access it. We know it's where it's at. And it's not an easy thing to come across and think about, like, hey, we need to have this plan. Not that every family needs to have this plan. I want to kind of clarify that piece. It's not that everybody, well, if you're in California, you should have a fire evacuation plan. But anyways, just it's important that parents and families are talking about these things, because there is, just noticing the clients I'm working with, kids that I'm working with, there is an increase in these suicidal thoughts and urges, and families are scared. And it's important that they're educating themselves and working with a therapist, if, you know, if it's clinically appropriate and indicated. Like, I don't just want for families just to be like, oh, Preston said that everybody needs to go to therapy, we all need to run and go to bust down the therapist's door. But if you feel like things are off, like, hey, like, let's get support. Let's kind of talk about things ahead of time and get to understand what we're experiencing and struggling with. So hopefully we don't get to this point. One thing you had said earlier too, of like parents, working with the parents, is we do have to build this alliance with them and build that trust. And with parents bringing kids into therapy, sometimes kids then think, oh, I'm just going to therapy now because I made these statements and I'm the problem, or parents think I just need to be fixed. Something's wrong with me. It's the system that needs to work together, and they need to show up for each other and process through this. And it's not the kid's fault. It's nobody's fault particularly, but just need to have these conversations and build that secure attachment with each other and know that my parents are going to be there if I need them, so that if I have these thoughts coming up, I know I can talk with them. I know that they're going to respond appropriately and we're going to work together. Not that I'm in trouble, but they're going to reassure me that I am okay. We're going to work through this together. And yeah, just knowing we're in this together is a huge part.
As much as it scares us when we hear these kinds of comments, there's also the reframe that we'd rather have these comments come out into the open, because a child who can externalize is a lot easier to track than a child who's internalizing these kinds of thoughts.
Yeah.
It's out in the open. We can talk about it and it's a flag and we know how to take it seriously and start having the conversations.
Absolutely. And the scariest thing is if they're internalizing it. Because if they're internalizing it, if they're not talking about things with us, we don't know what's going on in their minds.
But in some ways, don't you find that it's the externalizing kids who often end up in therapy more often than the internalizing kids?
Yeah. I mean, one thing that comes to mind is thinking of like, okay, sure, this child is quiet. They're internalizing. They're seen as potentially the good child. And the children that are kind of having the externalizing behaviors, getting all these emotions out, they tend to be labeled or seen as, oh, they're the bad child, or they have the challenges and concerns, which is that point of bringing your child to therapy. It's not because they're in trouble or they're the main issue. It's the family's going to therapy. We're working through this together. It's not one individual specific person that's causing all the issues, causing the issues in general.
I'm just listening to you, Preston, and I feel like I have a person of wisdom and resource on this topic in front of me. So like, I feel my brain, like I have a ton of questions for you.
Yes, always.
You've said so many amazing, helpful things already. And if I put myself into the hard place of being a kid who has these thoughts or feelings, and that's pretty easy for me to do based on my own history, I think what comes most for me is how hopeless I felt.
Yeah.
I really wanted someone to sense that and to reflect that back to me and speak to me basically about feeling hopeless. Because up until that moment as a kid, I had no idea what hopeless was. I was a really hopeful, joyful child. And then all of a sudden, there was this brand new thing that I was going through. And I really wanted an adult to get and help me understand hopeless.
Thank you, Rhonda. It's not easy to bring up and to just share that vulnerably. I really appreciate you bringing that up. It's extremely scary to be in a place like that. And to feel just that level of hopelessness, hopeless. And even just the ability to go back, thinking back to that experience and looking back to what you were needing in that moment is just to have somebody just recognize and show up for me, listen to me even, and tell me, help me understand even what I'm feeling and what it's like to be in this hopeless spot.
And to make space to really explore that and talk about it. Because, yeah, that does make me think of a little guy, probably the youngest child I worked with was about 5, who had made remarks like this, and parents were amazing. They brought him in right away. But even as we took the therapeutic hour to just explore this, a whole lot more poured out than the parents even realized was going on. And it was something about me needing to ask like more specific questions, or maybe just linger longer around the topic, that, you know, just one thing became another thing, became another thing. And so, as you're saying, Rhonda, when we have these really dark moments, we need someone who's willing to go into the darkness and tolerate it and explore it and just sit there, right? And see what else might come into focus.
Yeah. And as a therapist, that's where one of our roles comes in, where we can show up for kids and families in these dark, dark places. And it could be extremely scary. You know, like Catherine, you were saying earlier how like I slow things down, the tone of my voice, like it shows up. Sure, like I just picture a duck on the surface. They look all calm, cool, collected underneath. So like, yes, internally, we may have that coming up depending on our history and experience. And another part that you've talked about in the past, Catherine, is kind of leading into just a dark basement, like just the experiences, not knowing what's truly under there. Mm-hmm. Like if it's unknown to us, right? We've never been in that basement before. But we're going to go alongside and kind of guide them down there. And mm-hmm. maybe extremely scary, but we'll be in this together.
Like we'll walk down into that dark basement step by step, mm-hmm. maybe slightly ahead of them, leading them.
Yeah.
And then we're going to stop on every second or third stair and trust that our eyes are going to acclimate to the darkness, and we might start seeing more and more starts to become visible, right? Yeah. But we have to be in that together. And sometimes, I think as you're saying, and Rhonda, maybe you can attest to this, it's like we're even afraid of what's in there, right? The client is afraid of what's in there.
Oh, yes.
Terrified of what's in there. And so it's really hard to even, like we do need someone to guide us and be like, what else?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think another piece or layer to it as well is the level of safety that the child feels in the room. So if they aren't feeling safe to kind of let us into that, let parents into that darkness, being able to talk about those things, they may have like all these things lined up in a row. They want to talk about what they're feeling. But if they don't feel safe to do that in the room, they may clam up and makes it a little bit difficult.
There's that safety and, you know, are they comfortable to open up? And then I'm also thinking of ideation, like suicide ideation, where when you're at that level, you're actually ideating, you're like idealizing death. Mm-hmm. And that creates sort of an anesthetic, numbing kind of effect, right? To the tremendous pain you're in. And I think that when people are in that spot, they really want to talk about it. They want to kind of idealize and talk about what they're thinking and why it's better and what the plan is. And we have to sort of be ready for that and be ready to ask them about that too.
Yeah. Even if we're extremely scared to go into it, not knowing what we're getting into, it's extremely important that we're able to be direct about our questioning so that we're not just dancing around it a little.
Yeah.
a lot of the times what happens is people feel afraid to talk about it, because then we're like, are we putting these thoughts into their mind now, or these ideas into their mind, when really, you know, they have so much access to social media, to kids at school, or just all these other outlets that are feeding into their information or feeding information into them. So like, it's not necessarily that we're feeding these ideas to them. They're making these statements somewhere along the line. They've picked this up and have heard these things. And we want to be able to understand and make sure that they understand truly what they're talking about, and for us to understand what they're feeling and going through. Because if we're afraid to go into that hopelessness, then Rhonda, what you were saying earlier is like, I just needed somebody to guide me through that and to listen and show up for me in that way. Then we're missing these kids and, or people even, not just kids. Yeah. It's tough.
Catherine, I really like, I'm going to rewind. I'm going to go back to the dark basement and the acclimation that you were describing that happens every two or three steps. And what's interesting is I kind of felt like this, that happened as we talked to Preston. and so I just kind of noticing that just within this conversation itself, is it got a little easier to talk about every few minutes.
What was it that he was doing? What helped you?
Oh, it's definitely there's a tone, lack of a better word. There's a tone that you have, Preston. It's not really soft or tender. You're very, it's not quite that. It's something else. It's
like calm. Is it calm?
It's like smooth waters. You have this smooth waters way of talking. It's not monotone, but it's not particularly soft or tender. And whereas like for me, like I change the inflection of my voice a ton. That's just how I talk. And so crisis work has never really been my thing. But you must have a purpose, right, for why you have that kind of voice. And I think you're using your voice in a very beautiful way. But just recognizing just in this conversation that like I felt like the stairwell thing happened. And I, that image helps me so much, because I can use that image as I work with the parents, right? I can do my check-ins on the stairwell. How are you doing as we talk about this?
Mm-hmm.
And as we try to hold both the parent and the child at the same time.
And regulate yourself as you go down.
As you go down. Mm-hmm.
That's why I've wanted to spend more time with Preston, because he does have this, I think it's like a gifting or something. It's like people, I think it's people who go into crisis situations have to be able to like calm their nervous system somehow. They like get calmer when things are more dangerous. And so I've had some family situations like this that are, you know, that bring a level of danger. And I'm like, Preston, you're going into this family system with me, because my nervous system wants to get super anxious. And then I just want to get the safety plan for my own security, but I'm not necessarily being therapeutic in the moment to the family. But Preston has this way of when there's some danger, he'll go in and assess, but the way he does it is so smooth and step by step, and it takes a long time. But by the end of that hour and he's assessed, it's thorough. And everyone feels better, even through the assessment. Mm-hmm. And so what I've learned from you, Preston, is how to make a safety assessment therapeutic.
Oh, that just is mind-blowing.
Seriously, it's therapeutic. He's asking like the hardest questions in the world, and the person actually feels more stabilized.
Through the process that Preston brings.
Yeah.
Preston's process.
How did you do this? Like, did you learn how to do this?
Yeah. Foreign minds want to know.
Yeah. I mean, growing up, I come from a law enforcement background. So like,
okay.
Off there a little bit in just the law enforcement realm.
Wait, you yourself were in law enforcement?
I worked for probation right out of high school.
Oh, wow. Brilliant.
I was working with a lot of kids that just really were struggling behaviorally, obviously, if there's a lot of challenges there because they're in juvenile hall. And some of these kids were struggling with suicidal ideation, saying they were going to kill themselves and die by suicide. And when it came to those situations, there was either, well, you're going up to the holding tank, or we're going to talk about this. We're going to try to understand what you're going through, what you're experiencing. Two very different polarized ends of approaches. And the team that I primarily worked on, most of the time was the only male. So I had to have a presence that was, yes, firm, but also can calm and reduce situations. Along with that, I grew up in what's called an explorer, like Sheriff's Explorer program. So from like 13 to 21, I was in the explorer post for the local sheriff's department. And in that area, just growing up and learning about how to respond to situations, how to talk to people, and just what law enforcement does on a day-to-day basis, it was, you have to build a relationship with the community, know how to talk to people, because if you're escalating the situation, making the situation worse, your backup's 20, 30 minutes away. Like light sirens, that's the closest backup. Very rural. You'd maybe have 4 or 5 deputies on patrol for the whole county. So you needed to know how to talk to people. And because it was also a country rural area, also trying to, it's a little bit different of a pace from being in the city. So that's also a part of learning just my own pace.
Wow. I had no idea, Preston. See, we all come to this work through different pathways. I have to believe that how we get here matters just as much as where we're going with it and what we do with it. So thanks for sharing your history with us.
I appreciate you guys.
Yeah, it's really nice to get to know you, Preston. Thank you so much for sharing. And it sounds to me like you had to learn how to slow things down, and your goal is, let me de-escalate matters. Let me be a firm, stable presence, but I also seek to understand. But I really love, like, I want to de-escalate things. And then I suppose you've had so much experience, right? And when you have that many hours under your belt, you start getting more secure in what to do and how to hold people and
show up for them. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Appreciate that reflection too. Like, it definitely describes the experience.
Yeah. I do think there is an art to being therapeutic and showing up for someone and doing the clinical assessment piece at the same time. And I do think there is an art to doing it artfully.
Yes.
A de-escalating smooth way. I know how to just get in there and do the assessment and do the safety plan, and I can do that. Believe me, I can. But but to do it therapeutically, artfully, smoothly, where just the process itself adds stabilization to the system. Mm-hmm. Boy, do I have a lot to learn, Preston.
Oh, I have many things to learn too, but
thank you so much, Preston. Lovely to hear from you and to learn from you. Appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate you guys having me on.
Yes. Thank you, Preston. Thanks for your time and your wisdom. And stay tuned for the next episode in 2 weeks. Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Thanks, everyone. Ciao, ciao.
That's it for today, folks. Thank you for listening, and we hope to see you again for our next journey.